like the true-hearted man from the County Mayo.
Yeah, true-hearted man from the County Mayo, and am I ever delighted to welcome somebody I know, indeed for a long time, as a friend and as a great Irish-American, and indeed a great supporter of all things Irish. John Thierick, Dean Emeritus of Fordham University, and that's only one of numerous titles that indeed the list itself would take another 10 minutes, but let me welcome John Thierick. John, you're very welcome indeed.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the music.
Yes. So, you know, John, let's start at the beginning. You know, we have a very good friend of ours who wrote a book, and it was called Rolling Up the Carpet, Michael Scanlon, who actually lauded growing up in Highbridge in the Bronx. Now, you were actually born, bred, and buttered off the concourse, was it? On 163rd?
161st Street, you might say the lowland, down from Highbridge, near the Melrose train stop, not too far from Yankee Stadium, 161st Street.
Your parents, and it was, I would assume, predominantly Irish neighborhood at that point, was it?
There certainly were a number of Irish families, but there were also children of other nationalities in the neighborhood from Italy, Germany. So it really was a mixed in terms of the nationalities present.
Your family, tell us about your mom, your pop, your siblings, and indeed the apartment you grew up in.
My parents each left family farms in County Mayo. They didn't know each other over there. They traveled alone to America. My mother in 1928, my father in 1929, just before the Depression. They met either at an Irish dance or a home party, and got married in 1935. I was their firstborn in 1936. There would be four siblings who would follow me, two before the war and two after the war. My father spent time abroad working on military installations for military contractors. And he did everything imaginable before the war. Was a sand hog, worked on the milk trucks, worked on the waterfront. And after the war, he operated a trolley and then a bus, and retired from the work on with the bus company and surface transport company that I guess merged. And it was a wonderful growing up for us. There were five of us. We had a small apartment, two bedrooms. We had laundry hung from the ceiling in the kitchen. We worked around the kitchen table, doing our studying. And despite all of the distractions, we just ignored the distractions and did what we needed to do in terms of study. And it was like a village we grew up in. We just went around the corner. There was our church, St. Angelo Merisi, our school. There was a public library across the street. And then we had these playing fields for stickball and other games. So by the time I emerged as a law school graduate in 1961. I had really a very rich history in the South Bronx. My father brought home a paycheck, and we had part-time jobs, and never considered ourselves poor. We considered ourselves, part of a working class family.
Was it expected that if you were to go on from high school and go to third level education, that you also had to figure out a way to pay for it.
Yes, it was not easy for my father. And I recall my father when I was going to high school, being told that the tuition, it was a Catholic high school, Bishop Dubois, told that the tuition was $10. He said he couldn't afford $10. And Monsignor said, how about $5? My father said, yes. And I would just put a footnote on that. Years later, after I had, you know, been a practicing lawyer for a long time, I gave Cardinal O'Connor a check, and he wanted to know what the check was for. I said it was to reimburse the Archdiocese for the tuition my father couldn't afford to pay, and I put some interest on that as well.
Oh, my God. You have did your father and mother speak much about, you know, growing up in Ireland? Was it marginal? Was that a topic at all in the household?
It was in this sense that my mother sent back clothes to the families of both parents, and sent back each year a few dollars, and house parties in our apartment had friends and we'd come over. We had the Irish music all the time, and my mother could dance. My father played the accordion, so Ireland was very much present in our, without realizing it, in our bodies, so to speak, and very much part of our growing up experience.
Okay, you'd be known yourself indeed to render, you know, a blast of Irish songs. And, you know, some would look and say, my God, he must have come from a musical family. What kind of music did your father play on the accordion, on the melodeon?
What I remember him on the accordion was when my mother was doing the dances. My mother would do all kinds of step dances and the... it was that kind of music, and my mother would sing Kevin Barry and other, and we all cried when we heard Kevin Barry, and it was sort of you know, music that I couldn't put the words to, it was just wonderful to see the, you know, we would peek into the living room when the friends were over. We were not directly sitting with the friends. There wasn't enough room for that. And we just loved seeing that.
Did your parents, your relatives, speak much about the 1916, the revolution in Ireland? Was that a topic? Was there any involvement with any members of your family, in Ireland and in the movement, which in fact did result in having Ireland's 26 counties as a country of independence?
Yes, as I got older, my Uncle Pat, my mother's brother, who participated in the War of Independence along with his brother James Boyle, who was a senior officer in the west of Ireland. He talked a lot about, in a general kind of way. He didn't give details because he felt he had to honor a pledge, I think, of you don't talk about it. You participate, you do what you can for your country, and you don't go thereafter talking about that. So we did have as we got older, we did have a sense of that part of our family history, but not a lot of that history, but some of that history.
My guest, John Feerick, Dean Emeritus. So you graduate law school, and now it is high time for you to indeed you know, make some money, develop a career. And you joined what was a very lucrative position in a law firm here in New York. And one day you get a call from Fordham University with this offer of a job. Were you married at that time?
Yes. I think what you're describing is I was a practicing lawyer for 21 years with what was a 10-lawyer firm, essentially, when I started at the firm. It developed a reputation in the corporate field, and the firm grew. It kept growing, and I practiced in an area of labor law and employment law, you might say. And one day, because I was very active at Fordham University and also in the bar associations of New York, I got a call from the president of Fordham University, Father Finley, who asked to meet with me and asked me if I would consider putting my name in for the deanship of the school. And I was taken back by that and overwhelmed by what he said about the importance to the Society of Jesus of Fordham Law School, and could I come over and help develop a vision for the future of the school. And I was never about money. So even though I was successful in law practice in that regard, and that made it possible for me to even take that step, because at the time I had 6 children.
So you go home to your wife, Emily, and say, guess what? I know we need the money. We're a big family. But it would take a very steep cut in revenue and in salary for me to take this job. She didn't throw you out of the house. Right?
No. Actually, she was very quiet. Because for 21 years, I worked all hours of the day and weekends in law practice. And I think quietly she thought that this was maybe an opportunity for me to get more balance in my life in terms of my time. My father, on the other hand, thought I was crazy to leave where I was. And my mother, who was not well at the time and declining in terms of her memory, she was very quiet.
You, again, having accepted the role as dean of Fordham Law School, had you any idea that this was a career that would, you know, where you would spend 2 decades, a record, of service as the dean of any law school? But had you any short-range or long-range plan?
The only long-range plan I had when I was a practicing lawyer, you might say, I was very active as a practicing lawyer beyond law practice in bar associations, in writing and participating in causes. And I always had a thought that I would love to do public service full-time and then come back to whatever I would be doing. And I saw the deanship, when it was presented to me by Father Finley, as an opportunity to do that. It wasn't government service, which is probably what I was thinking of. It was a different kind of service, but it all added up to the same thing in my mind.
How did you become involved and, in fact, become a senior framer of the U.S. Constitution's 25th Amendment? First of all, what is the 25th Amendment? Maybe you can spell that one out for us.
Let me try to do it in 15 seconds. It deals with how to handle a disability of a president of the United States. That's number one. And number two, it provides for filling a vacancy that might occur in the vice presidency. And there was no provision in the Constitution on filling a vacancy. And with respect to the disability of a president, while it was a provision in the original Constitution, it was quite ambiguous, and there was a need for clarification.
Has that become, an issue through the years and through the decades, or is that one shelved for an emergency situation? What's your read on this?
Yes, three major cases stand out. James Garfield was assassinated, but for 80 days he hovered between life and death, and the cabinet and vice president did not know how to deal with that, they did whatever they could do in their particular positions. And then President Wilson had a stroke, and for probably the rest of his term, he was not able to have the full possession of his faculties, one might say, and his wife and secretary helped take over parts of the government that normally would be done by the president. And then President Eisenhower on three occasions had disabilities while in office, won a heart attack. And he started to urge that the Congress of the United States deal with how do you handle such a case when a president becomes disabled. But Congress did not act on it at that time. And then when President Kennedy was assassinated a few years later, and the vice president took over the presidency, Lyndon Johnson, leaving a vacancy in the vice presidency, there was a chant that developed in the country. You might say, in part, as a memorial to the president, we should deal with this problem. And then eventually that led to the 25th Amendment.
Now, the 25th Amendment really was never designed to remove a president for or vice president for any reason other than disability. I mean, it was not something you could throw out there and say, we'll get rid of this fellow and activate the 25th Amendment.
That's correct. It has nothing. The vice president is not covered. It only deals with covered in terms of his disability. There's no provision in the 25th Amendment that deals with that. With respect to the president, there is, and it allows the president himself to declare his disability, in which case the vice president becomes the acting president. And if the president is unconscious or his plane goes down and he can't reach a president, the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, the heads of the executive departments, have the power to say, the president's disabled, you, the vice president, take over as acting president for the duration of the disability. There's no provision in the 25th Amendment that allows anyone to take away the office of the president, take away the president's office.
Yeah.
That can be done by impeachment, but it can't be done in the 25th Amendment.
And as has been pointed out, that was a very good provision, so that in framing the 25th Amendment, that had no political implications at all, that this was something.
No, you're absolutely right. It was two-thirds of each House of Congress and three-fourths of the state legislatures pretty quickly put the amendment into the Constitution.
Your interest, obviously, in addition to, being a dean of Fordham University Law School, your interest beyond that in terms of, getting involved way, way beyond the normal terms of dean was to get yourself into an area that most wouldn't choose, i.e., conflict resolution, looking after and becoming, I suppose at the time, somewhat considered a a left-wing liberal in terms of tackling issues like the poor, the marginalized, and your commitment to justice. A mammoth undertaking. Did you do that in stages, or was there a blueprint that you set for yourself?
Well, opportunities presented themselves at different points that and in law practice, I was very much involved in dealing with conflict. I represented clients, labor unions, also many employers in different industries, so there would not be a conflict. So I and when I became dean of the law school, having that background of experiences, law firms, courts, and others would call on me, would I serve as a mediator, might I serve as an arbitrator, dealing with conflicts. And I was acceptable to parties involved in those disputes because I had that actual practice background, and it was not identified as a management lawyer or a labor lawyer, and I didn't hold myself out doing that. I didn't anticipate having those opportunities when I became dean of the school, but they came along and continued to come along right up to the present time. And in terms of the poor, after I had left the deanship, I was asked to be special master of family homelessness in New York City, and I worked with two social workers. And I came very much to feel that I should devote my years after being a practicing lawyer and after being dean of a law school to making service of the poor a part of my life. And that eventuated in the school creating a Center for Social Justice that's very heavily involved in what you just mentioned.
Yes, and again, bearing your own, it is the Theric, pavilion, of the law school of Fordham University. Can I ask you, just in terms of your own relationships, whether that was with, mayors such as Koch and Giuliani and on to right through to Mayor Bloomberg. When you get an assignment, is that something that they are involved in themselves, or is this kind of an assignment that they say, John Ferrix, the man, hand that over to him? How does that work? And also, might I add to that, Governors Cuomo, even Hugh Carey, how does that come about?
Well, I would say that all of my involvements all of them have been as independent, as a neutral, somebody that basically doesn't receive any compensation. Once or twice I did when I was the overseer of labor disputes at the convention center, but I had all of the fee I was entitled to sent over to the law school. I never wanted to have a fee when I was doing a public service where I had a full-time job. So I really was independent. And for example, homelessness. Major controversy between the mayor and the Legal Aid Society about homelessness in New York City. And both parties asked me to be a key special master in resolving, to the extent one can, the issues between them. So at times, mayors get, I can recall Mayor Koch angry at me at one point. I can recall Mario Cuomo yelling at me at one point, but notwithstanding that, you got to do what you think is right after you've thoroughly examined whatever it is that you have to examine.
Now, you served, in so many roles, but as president of the New York City Bar Association, again, I wouldn't call it a hornet's nest, but that was a huge challenge. also.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. That was one of the greatest honors that could be conferred on, you might say, on a lawyer. You don't campaign for it. There's a committee that's set up, and I was asked if I was, then dean at the law school, if I would take it on, and it was very hard because I was very active as dean. But it gave me an opportunity to put an emphasis on a few things, and one was do things that can be helpful in New York City, because we are a bar association in New York City, and we ought to be doing things, and also develop a greater program of lawyers being involved in conflict resolution. I pushed the idea of doing more than just a commercial course in arbitration. There should be a lot of activity by the bar having to do with mediation and other kinds of ways of resolving disputes. So those were important opportunities that enabled me to also express not only my own values, but the values of the bar and also Fordham Law School. I hesitated on some of these assignments as it would take too much time, but Father O'Hare, God bless him, he died recently, he said, do it. This would be a good thing for the dean of our law school to do.
Yeah, and of course, then you went on to chair the State Commissions on Government Integrity.
I don't recommend that for my children, but you're in a fishbowl and very, very difficult. I was hesitant about taking that on when Governor Cuomo asked me to do so. And I said, I'm not a prosecutor. I'm just an academic at that time, dean of law school.
Yeah.
And he said, no. But then when I did take it on, because they pushed me pretty hard to do it, I did make sure that we had a very strong prosecution staff with strong background and former investigators for the IRS and the FBI and others. So it turned out to be a very, very strong commission.
The day came when you were notified, when you were asked, if you would be the medalist of the American Bar Association, some 400,000 members strong. That must have been for you a great day. A great day in the sense that you, as known for your own humility, your great advocacy for the poor, the downtrodden, your career, in law practice, and your dedication to public service and political reform, all of the honors that you received. When you get a call to say, look, we have chosen you, 400,000 strong, we want you, and to honor you, what was your reaction to that?
I cried. And I was told by the then president of the American Bar Association, Linda Klein, and the dean of law school was present, and I didn't know why they wanted to meet with me, they told me just that I was going to receive the ABA medal, which is given to one person each year, and I did not feel worthy of it. When one looked at the list of who those honorees were in the past, including a hero of mine, Thurgood Marshall, they thought that my citizen volunteer and participation work as a lawyer, including the 25th Amendment and some of the things you mentioned, justified the unanimous selection by the Board of Governors of the ABA. And I still feel very, very humbled about having received that award, and very, very and the first thing I said when I accepted the award was, I talked about my parents, and but for my parents, none of that would have happened.
Which I'd like to bring back to your parents. You had basically, like many other, sons and daughters of immigrants and immigrants from Ireland, there came a day when you wanted to know more. And I don't think there's another person on the face of the earth who actually delved into your own background, your family background. And you didn't stop, as most of us would say, okay, I went home, I saw the home place, and I see where my father came from, my mother came from. You went much deeper than that. Can you give us kind of a little synopsis on that one?
Yeah, let me try to hit that. I know your time runs short on these interviews. It was the most difficult time of my life when my father died in 1988. My mother was severely disabled at that point with memory loss, and she was at my father's insistence, she was in a home, and I decided that I needed to go to Ireland for the first time. I was then 52 years of age, and just see where they were born, meet the relatives of theirs, siblings who were still alive, and when I was over there in my first week in Ireland, my mother died. And I came back right away, and I mourned their loss. And the way I was able to deal with my mourning over a 10-year period was during the summers when I had a chance to go to Ireland, visit cemeteries, go to libraries about the trains they might have taken to Cork to come to America. I still plan to do more of that if I have any time left after my present age, that's really why I miss them. And when Fordham came up with the cover of my book and showed me the pictures of my parents, and along with my two brothers and myself, I cried, really. I couldn't think of a better picture for the book because it had my parents, the Statue of Liberty, and I'm still a complete in my family history. There's a lot I don't know still, and that's why I didn't put a family tree there in the book, because And talking to other people, they were speculating about the people in my background, ancestry, going back centuries. And I said, no, I just don't want to. I don't want to put things in a book that's not accurate.
Tell me about the access to information, the level of cooperation that you got, in again tracking your own ancestry. Where did you start? Where did you get? Did you stumble across information that was not readily available?
Oh, most of it wasn't available. When I made that first trip to Ireland, I think it was probably on the first full day we had there. My uncle John Boyle, who lived as a bachelor, was in a home. And I went to the home, and I asked if I could, I cried when I met him, the first time I met him. He asked me to take him to the shrine at Knock. And then I asked him, can he take me to the cemeteries where my ancestors are buried? And he did. And it was hard for him because walking in the cemeteries, but... So he was my access to... beginning that understanding of my roots on my mother's side. And on my father's side, I didn't have the same kind of luck. Some of my first cousins, based on my father's side, became into the picture and were enormously helpful to me. That's the Felix side, and my father's mother was McDermott, and And just talking to people, I found people who remembered my mother, quite old at that point. I talked to them, and assumed a lot more information. I went into court records, or I should say records of, with wills and things like that, and
yeah.
spoke to pastors of the parishes involved. And it took, that's why it took me almost 20 years to do the book.
Yes, and it's a terrific book. It's a great book. Just want to ask you, though, about the level of interest, say, for your kids, your grandchildren, and, you know, a lot of people, particularly in their senior years, either wish they had written a book or try to at least some kind of legacy, including Ireland and your parents, your ancestry. Was part of the reason that you tackled this book is that you wanted your children, your grandchildren, your friends, those who probably would not get the type of information that you've incorporated into an illustrious life. And again, we're very proud. By the way, your parents, next parish to my own being Attymass, and the Foxford connection there. But was that a motivation, considering that this happened over 20 years?
I'd say that there were two principal motivations. That clearly was one, that there was no history by anyone in the family, and we have a lot of members of the family right now out there, grandchildren, my late brother's children. When he died, there were 18 grandchildren. And, so there's, I wanted everyone to have a greater sense of our history, and with a focus on my parents. And they slipped away. The remains are in cemeteries, and they gave birth, you might say, to so many people of the next generation, and the generation after that, and another generation right now. And I just thought that I needed to tell their story. And I understand, and I didn't know, realize it, that when I was in second year at Fordham College, I was trying to tell this story because my daughter Jean, a professor at John Carroll, told me she found the paper I wrote when I was a sophomore at Fordham College telling the story of my parents.
And in hindsight, well, I know that you said your mother indeed had, issues with memory towards the end of her days. But what about your father? Did he get over the fact that he thought you were perhaps making somewhat of a wild decision in giving up a very lucrative practice to become dean? At what level, before your father died, did he understand what you were doing, or was he impressed by the depth of your research into your family and your family roots?
I would say that once I made the decision, I didn't sense any disagreement at that point. He just accepted it, and he was having issues, medical issues. That was 1982, in terms of breathing, a form of emphysema.
Yes.
And I was always there for my parents. I had done well in law practice. I had been able to help them get a house in Lake Carmel, and I assured him that all would be well, and he accepted that, and by the way, with respect to my father, he never saw his parents again My mother had lost her father when she was six, and she never saw her mother again. And both never saw certain siblings again. And all of that became part of why I wanted to tell their story.
Yeah. Was that acceptable? And I know the answer. When most people of that generation, when they left Ireland, they knew in their heart and soul that this was one way, that the likelihood of their ever returning to Ireland was somewhere between slim and none.
Yeah, well, I had a dream when I was going through school that as soon as I got out, I finished my schooling, it was law school, I would give my parents a ticket. I would pay for the tickets. Remember going over to a travel agency on Fordham Road in the Bronx and saying I want two tickets so I could send my parents back to Ireland. And as the years went on, whenever they wanted to go back, they could, and they did.
It's a great story and part of an amazing book called That Further Shore, a memoir of Irish roots and American promise. Fordham Press, I want to tip off those who, Fordham University Press, first of all, they distribute the book, but also you get a 30% discount from there. John Thierrick, before you go, I just want on a personal level to acknowledge and to thank you for, again, two very memorable experiences in my own life. One, the Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City, and you were indeed a founding member of that, making that possible too. And more recently, your tremendous success in bringing, the attention to Kylemore Abbey and the sisters at Kylemore Abbey, who were all but, on the street with very, very little support from anywhere. Our friend John Thierrick took the bull by the horns, first of all, on both of those occasions, but in particular, Kylemore Abbey. Tell us a little bit about that.
I want to thank you for mentioning those causes because I had the honor to serve with you on the Irish Hunger Memorial under the leadership of Jim Gill, the late Jim Gill, who was such an extraordinary person. And in terms of Kylemore, on that first week in Ireland, I saw Kylemore, and it was the most beautiful place imaginable. And then when my mother died that week, and I came home, I wanted a memorial for them somewhere in Ireland, and I thought about that trip and decided that if the sisters could put my parents' name on a pew or somewhere in a Gothic church that's part of Kylemore, it would honor me great, not honor me, but I would be so grateful for that because I didn't know the sisters, and I just communicated by letter to someone and said I'd be happy to pay for it. And today that Gothic church, that pew is still there and has their names there. The sisters are wonderful, and I look forward to working with you, Adrian, and other members of the Irish community to help them with their first monastery that will open in the next few years, I think, and that will be a godsend.
When you came on my program at that point, I had a misconception, and you have reminded me, in case I would forget anything about it, is that I thought that you were, doing a whip around for these sisters who you know, were in tough times and coming to the end of their tether, so to speak. And boy, did I suffer for that one.
No, not at all. I often describe myself as a boy from the Bronx who, as long as I'm on my feet, I'm going to push away what I think is right. And those sisters, I thought, that deserved whatever contribution I could make, and we're going to get there.
We get there, and again, as to where what is happening there, Kylemore Abbey, again, the story of Kylemore Abbey was indeed attributable to the sisters. Who had a great teaching school. It was all girls at one point, considered by some as an elitist school, which couldn't be further from the truth, because everybody looked at Kylemore Abbey and said they must be doing very well. Truth of the matter was, John Ferrick, that at the time you made us aware of it, those sisters were... because of the condition, the rotten condition of Kylemore Abbey and the dormitories, they were, you know, being farmed out to B&Bs, and it was incredible the treatment that they had. You led and continue to lead an organization that, first of all, resulted in, you know, transforming and making a chapel, you know, in Kylemore Abbey, and now well on their way to the first ever monastery, which is, you know, that's an incredible feat, and but you've done it, and you're doing it, and we're delighted to be affiliated with you.
You were a big part of that, Adrian, and the success of that's going on, and obviously, there are still challenges that the cost of everything has gone up, and yet the sisters have an abbey that is, I think, the major tourist attraction in Ireland. Once the tourism picks up, Dublin would be first, I would say, and after that, from what I'm told, Kylemore Abbey ranks as very, very popular and at the top of the tourist attractions in Ireland.
And well, it should. John Ferrick, Dean Emeritus of Fordham University Law School. The book, That Further Shore, a memoir of Irish roots and American promise, Fordham Press, Fordham University Press in New York. The friend's best way, actually, to get more information is www.fordhampress.com. Very proud to be able to say that I cherish my friendship with my guest today, John Ferrick.
I feel the same way about you and your lovely wife and family. Thank you.
Thank you.